Good morning, everybody. If you wouldn't mind taking your seats, I would appreciate it. We've got a packed agenda today, so time is of the essence. For those of you I don't know, my name is Christy Hilsman, and I'm a manager of communications at NFA, and I'd like to thank all of you for joining us. Before we go ahead and get started, I have just a few housekeeping reminders. So first and foremost, we want today to be conversational and as useful to all of you as possible. So please feel free to raise your hand at any point in time, ask questions, and we will actually have a couple of staff stationed in the back of the room who can then run over to you with a microphone so that everybody in the room can hear your question. On that note, we will also be audio recording today's workshop for your reference at a later time. So it is important that you speak into the microphone so that we have a record of all your questions and then the answers that our panelists then provide. Additionally, I wanted to point out that at each of your tables, there are stacks of evaluations, and I know people will be coming in and out for different sessions. So before you leave, if you wouldn't mind filling one of those out, I would really appreciate it. We use that feedback to then plan forthcoming member education, whether it's workshops, webinars, or something else. And with that, I think I will turn it over to Joe Zangri, who is our Managing Director of Examinations in OTC Derivatives. He's going to give some opening remarks, and then we will go ahead and get started with our agenda. Thanks again.
Thanks, Christy. Good morning. I'd like to thank you all for coming to the NFA Spring Workshop. Not really spring-like today, but we made it. So we at NFA have worked hard to provide what we think will be an informative presentation across a number of topics. We'll spend the morning session on swap dealer issues, including an update on swap dealer exams, recent common exam findings, and expectations for upcoming exams. And that'll take us through about the first hour. We'll then talk a little bit about the swaps proficiency requirements for swap AAPs. Then we'll cover issues that affect both our swap dealer members and our futures members, namely NFA enforcement activity, a cybersecurity regulatory update to NFA rules, and a cybersecurity panel discussion. We will end the morning session with remarks from Ron Filler on NFA member resources. And for those staying, the afternoon session will be dedicated for futures compliance issues. It's an aggressive agenda, as Christy said, yet we hope that for all of you today you feel comfortable asking questions. It's important for NFA to learn what your questions and concerns are as we work together to preserve the integrity of our markets and stay current on the issues that affect us all. With that, let me get right into the first panel. Xunhao Wang, our Director of NFA Derivatives Exams, and Tammy Wang, the AD of NFA Derivatives Exams, will be joining me on the panel. And I'll turn it over to Xunhao.
Thank you, Joe. Good morning. As Joe mentioned, we have put together an agenda that we believe will be informative. In the swap dealer exam update, we'll cover three things. First, we will discuss the changes we have made to our examination program, focusing on what is different in the way that we conduct examinations. We'll also highlight some of the enhancements we have made to our approach for determining which firms to examine in upcoming months. Next, because many of you are interested in knowing what we are seeing at other firms, we will provide the themes or summary of key findings resulting from our examinations we have conducted over the past year. We have also included what we consider good practices that we have seen at other firms, and we hope you would consider adopting, if not yet in place, at your particular firm. Finally, at the end, we'll share what rule areas may be in scope for the next exam of your firm, something I think everyone would be interested in. I'll now hand it over to Joe, who will provide more details in the examination approach.
Thanks, Shannon. So we are implementing something that we call the hybrid approach, and we started this approach last summer. We've been performing exams for 5 years, but this is sort of a new evolution in what we're doing. We initially did this and applied it to non-U.S. members. It's proven so effective, we're adopting it across all firms as part of our examinations. And let me tell you a little bit about what the hybrid approach is. So staff first review documentation provided by firms at NFA's offices rather than on-site at the firm. During that review, we then have telephone or teleconference discussions with the firms to ask questions about the information that we're going through, and then we go on-site. As a result of that, staff is on-site for a much shorter time, usually anywhere between 1 to 3 weeks, rather than the 3 to 6 weeks under the traditional approach. While on-site, the discussions with the firms are more focused, and the questions are much more targeted to issues that we determine from the in-house documentation review and the calls with the firms. Also, if we find out early on at the firm that there may be an escalation issue, we can do that while staff is on site. So if we need to bring an associate director or a director or myself, we don't have to come back after we leave, you know, and set up another time. Early feedback from the firms that we've worked with in this approach has been they've been very appreciative of it. Overall, the time for examination is still consistent with the previous approach. We're just not on site as longer. And the number of types of issues spotted is in line with previous exams. So it seems to be working. Are there any questions on that before I move on? Okay, I'll move on. Turning to engagement with non-U.S. regulators, NFA has always looked to strengthen the relationship with other regulators. For non-U.S. exams, we do establish contact with the foreign regulators to inform them that we'll be conducting an exam on one of their regulated entities. We've been in contact with various regulators, such as the FCA in the UK, ASIC and APRA in Australia, and in Canada, OSFI, the OSC, and the AMF. And we'll continue to reach out to other regulators as we move into other jurisdictions that we're examining. The next thing I'd like to talk about is firm prioritization. And so I mentioned at this workshop about a year ago that we've developed a system to analyze qualitative and quantitative data to help determine the firm's examination priorities on a risk-based approach. NFA will examine any and all requirements under Part 23, and what we're able to do is by collecting data, which has evolved and become richer over the years, we've actually been able to target the exam experience through self-reported matters, market and regulatory events, recently collected credit and market risk data, and standardized submission of notice of swap valuation disputes. So we've built a process that allows us to systematically evaluate this data to assess the firm's risk profile, which then determines the firm's examination priority. And it's worth mentioning that one overriding factor is whether a firm has been examined at all. If he has not, it will usually come to the top of the list. And it's also worth mentioning that we do consider the firm's remediation efforts and resolution of issues from past exams as well, which could be a mitigating factor to bring down their risk quotient. And lastly, I want to turn to examination scope. So the first part of what I talked about is where the firm is in the risk ranking for to be examined. And examination scope is once we determine we're going to examine that firm, what is the scope of that examination going to be? So when we consider what to examine at a firm, we look at the factors that determine the risk prioritization, and then we do a deep dive into each subcomponent of the part areas within those subcomponents have the highest risk for the firms, and those are the ones that we start to test. We also consider examining areas that have not been examined for a particular firm. And this is all done as part of the planning phase. Of course, if we have reason to expand or contract the examination as we go through the exam, we may do that as well. But we do go in with a targeted idea. And we've seen that this approach so far has led to more effective exams and provides firms the feedback as to the areas they need to focus on. Before I turn it over to Tammy and Chun, I just ask if there are any questions on any of the slides I've presented. Okay.
Thank you. I guess you're all quite familiar with our exam approach. So next, we'll move straight into the themes we have identified in exams. As many of you may know, if we have examined you over the past year, our current exam included a number of different rule areas. It may have included margin, segregation, business conduct standards, BCDR, cybersecurity, SDR, quite a bit. However, for today's presentation, we will only focus on the rule areas where we are seeing more issues. These areas are segregation of IAM, swap data reporting, and business conduct standards. But before we describe the issues we are seeing from our examinations, we will first briefly review the rule requirements. We will not go over all the requirements. As you know, they can be extensive. So the rule requirements we cover will be more specific to the types of findings we have seen. In addition, we'll talk about market practice and trading incidents that have been reported to us, in particular with respect to unauthorized trading. So now we will continue, and Tammy will start with the segregation rules.
I will start by summarizing the segregation rules. Segregation rules are applicable when firms two cases where IAM initial margins may be posted, but it's not subject to CFTC margin rules, such as when initial margin may be required in a binaural agreement between the swap dealer and counterparty. As you may already know, segregation rules are being simplified. There are three main changes under the proposed rules. First, the swap dealer will no longer be required to send an annual notice of the right to segregate. Second, the notice does not have to be sent to individuals with specific titles at the firm, such as responsible officer or CRO. Lastly, the firm is no longer required to list two custodians in the notice. However, there are three key requirements that remain. First, the firm need to send initial notice of the right to segregate prior to the transaction of the first unclear swap for which initial margin could be posted by contract. Second, for counterparties choose not to segregate, the firm needs to send a quarterly report on whether back office procedures relating to margin and collateral whether were in compliance with the counterparty agreements. Lastly, if a counterparty elect to seg, the firm needs to establish a tri-party agreement to segregate the initial margins. The segregation rule is to help secure a counterparty's collateral in the event a swap dealer defaults. Of interest, based on our examinations, we have seen only a small number of counterparties that have elected to segregate. However, we do notice that many counterparties have pre-existing segregation accounts. So now I'm going to go over more common issues pertaining to this rule area. With the rule being simplified, our exam has been focusing on what remains in the proposed rules. Also, since many counterparties elect not to seg, the findings are mostly related to two areas. One, the firm are not sending initial notice of the right to segregate initial margins. Second, the firm are not sending quarterly reports on whether back office procedures are in compliance with agreements. These failures occur either because a firm forgot to send a notice, or the firm did not properly identify the population of counterparties who should receive the notice. For example, if you are a non-US swap dealers and did not correctly identify US persons, then a notice may not have been sent. If there are no questions, I will hand over to Shuna, so I will take some questions if you have any. Okay.
Okay, so we'll then move on to the other rule area where we have seen, you know, quite a number of issues, which is swap data reporting. For swap data reporting, our exams are only focused on the requirements applicable to the swap dealer. There are requirements applicable to the CEF, DCM, and users, for example. So what is applicable to the swap dealer are the reporting of off-facility trades, which is really trades not executed on a CEF or DCM. As I mentioned, the CEF or DCM will report those trades. Many of you may be familiar, the SDR rules are very extensive, and the requirements can be very specific and numerous. But at a high level, I'll summarize the three areas that we focus our work on. The rules require...
Next slide.
Okay, there we are. Yeah. The rules require the swap dealer to report transactions real-time to the SDR as soon as technologically practicable, or ASATP. This allows the swap transactions and pricing data to be disseminated to the public in real-time. Another requirement is reporting creation data, or the primary economic terms of a swap, and confirmation data to the SDR ASATP, but no later than the time frame established for a particular asset class. These time frames, if you read the regulations, vary from 15 minutes for off-facility swaps subject to clearing up to 2 hours for commodity swaps. The third type of reporting requirement is reporting of continuation data and life cycle event data. These include, for example, corporate actions, novations, or terminations of swaps. And also, you're required to report valuation data. Continuation data is required to be reported daily, and this allows, really, the swap information in the SDR to remain current and accurate. So I will next move on to where we are seeing the issues in SDR. It is clearly a rule area where we identify issues in almost all of our examinations. It is also a rule area which has the highest number of instances of noncompliance that firms self-report to NFA. The most common issue we have seen is the failure to report trades or reporting the trades inaccurately. Firms are continuing to have sporadic incidents of reporting certain types of trades, not reporting certain types of trades over a period of time. For example, we have seen a failure to report real-time data for FX trades for X number of days. We are also seeing inaccurate or incomplete reporting. For example, we have seen reporting execution time for confirmation time, or not reporting execution time. So as many of you know, when we conduct our examinations, we also look at the firm's processes and we also do sample testing. And even though we choose a pretty small sample to test, quite often, without exceptions, we will find issues with the reporting. And I think part of that goes back to the extensiveness of the rules and also to the infrastructure that the firm has created for their reporting. So I'll talk a bit about what are some of the more root causes we have seen for misreporting or failure to report. The majority of the issues are because of system, are system related. We have seen where you have made programming changes or code changes to your systems that inadvertently affect your reporting processes downstream. Another type of system issue we have seen, and we have I won't say it so far, is the reporting of FX swaps. FX swaps are reported by reporting two forwards which are linked, or a spot and a forward which are linked. What we have seen is that firms are sometimes not linking these transactions. So if you do not link these transactions, you're not reporting the FX swap correctly. Instead, you're just reporting FX spot and FX forwards, and you're not even supposed to report FX spot. So that is high level some of the systemic issues that we have seen. But we're also seeing, you know, misreporting could occur because of you have the underlying data you're relying on is not accurate. So if you do not have good referential data, such as good product data or good counterparty data, then you're not likely to accurately identify the trades that should be reported to the SDR. So if you haven't completed, and Tammy will talk about this in the coming up, if you haven't gotten all your counterparty information and you're not able to identify U.S. persons, for example, you would not be able to identify the trades that should be reported if you have to report trades for U.S. persons. In particular, I just want to mention that I said U.S. persons, and if you are a U.S. swap dealer, it's pretty straightforward. You're pretty much reporting every trade. But if you're a non-U.S. swap dealer, the rules only apply if your counterparty is a U.S. person. So therefore, that becomes especially important for non-U.S. swap dealers to have good counterparty data. Another area we have seen issues is with respect to late reporting. The CFTC rules require trades to be reported ASATP, but not later than certain time frames, depending on the product. Reasons we have seen for late reporting are batching of trades and delayed trade input into systems. However, we do see firms are attempting to try to report timely. Many firms are monitoring their reporting time frames. If your firm is currently not doing it, I would recommend it. We have seen firms set their reporting time frames for monitoring at 15 minutes, which is the shortest rule requirement time frame across the different asset classes. As I mentioned earlier, the time frames span from 15 minutes for off-facility swaps subject to clearing and up to 2 hours for commodity swaps. So if you set a target of 15 minutes, you should be able to comply with all the requirements. So once after you have reported the trades to an SDR, if errors are detected, rules require the firm to correct the errors promptly. We found that firms may obtain reports from the DTCC, which is the SDR, to identify errors, but they do not review these reports regularly. In order to meet promptly, I would suggest that these reports be reviewed daily. In addition, we have seen another good practice we have seen at firms is to identify trade omissions. Many firms do reconciliations between their internal systems and what was reported to the DTCC. This is an important step because if you don't report it to the DTCC, then the DTC would not know about it and would not be able to tell you that the trade was missing. Lastly, we have seen firms use vendors for reporting. And yes, we also test those. And we have also identified cases where the vendor was not accurately reporting. Keep in mind that although you have contracted with the vendor to do your SDR reporting, that you are still responsible for compliance. We therefore recommend that firms perform some level of due diligence, look for completeness, look for accuracy, and look for timeliness of reporting by your vendors. This concludes the my prepared section on the SDR reporting, and if there's any questions at this time. Yes.
In situations where you've seen issues with the accuracy of reporting, have the expectation been that firms historically re-report the accurate data or just fix going forward to ensure that the fields are the appropriate fields?
If generally the answer is yes, you should correct, because the rules do require you to correct errors, right? So if you do see inaccurate data report, inaccurate reporting, you should make that correction as required by the rules. If you have noted that it's not the one or two trades, but it's something that happened over a period of time and you're talking about hundreds or thousands of trades, I would strongly recommend that you, one, notify NFA, notify the CFTC, and work out the time frame for re-reporting these trades.
Hi. How do you recommend to address the issue of allocated trades? So if we have real-time reporting with a fund manager and the trade is allocated to funds after trading, then for U.S. asset managers, that's easy. We just report everything. But for non-U.S. managers facing non-U.S. swap dealers, and if a U.S. fund is allocated trades, then you would inevitably late for real-time reporting purposes.
Yes, I recognize that quite often when trades are executed with an investment manager and it has to be allocated, sometimes that allocation information comes later. I think you try to preempt this as much as possible by first developing a kind of protocol with your investment manager to try to get any kind of new account information as soon as possible. You know, barring that, I know there will be certain times when it happens that you don't know the counterparty information until maybe hour, 2 hours after the trade is executed. I would recommend that you stay on top of it promptly and be able to evidence that you have proactively tried to get this information and to report it as soon as possible. If you could show good due diligence and be proactive in there, I think that will help you.
You mentioned at the beginning of your review a self-reporting to the NFA. Do you not consider, or maybe I should put it in the positive, do you consider the self-reporting to the CFTC, which is under programs put out by the Division of Enforcement, sufficient?
Quite often we encourage firms to report both to the NFA and the CFTC. If a firm calls NFA and reports only to NFA, and it's a significant event, we consider significant, you know, we advise the firm to report to the CFTC, and quite often, you know, NFA will also join that call. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Not quite.
Okay.
Because the CFTC Division of Enforcement has programs and guidance that they've put out on encouraging parties to self-report when they identify a problem. And hopefully that leads to a cooperative approach by the Division of Enforcement. So my question is, not if you call the NFA and the NFA tells you to call the CFTC, but the reverse. You contact the CFTC, Division of Enforcement, they actually don't tell you to call the NFA. So the question is, if you've notified the CFTC, Division of Enforcement, as you're supposed to, Are you satisfied with that, or will you consider it a deficiency if you haven't also been told?
I think deficiency might be too strong. I would say we encourage you to also contact NFA. We like to hear this also directly from the firm and not to hear it maybe months later from the CFTC. I think that helps us to be able to be a better regulator and also to kind of stay on top of events that impact our members.
Thank you.
And I would add to that, let us know that you've told the CFTC. Because more than likely the CFTC will be, you'll be working directly with the CFTC and will know of it, which will be helpful when we are thinking about our exams and things like that.
Hi. In terms of the remediation of some of these points, and from a sort of a foreign swap dealer perspective, when you need to obviously comply with other trade transaction reporting regimes, and particularly on data quality and controls, how much you can leverage of those broader controls around data quality, integrity, et cetera, that you have in place for other regulatory regimes, or those need to be more sort of tailored to sort of the swap dealer reporting specifics? I guess I'm trying to understand in terms of the kind of the consistency point across regulatory regimes, and obviously some of these points are common to other regimes in terms of data quality, and how much you can sort of give some input on that.
So I think if you're talking about different regimes, the CFTC reporting rules and other regimes, I know, for example, in the Canadian regulators also look at SDR reporting. What is required to be reported, there could be some overlap, but there also could be differences, right? And, so right now, from an NFA perspective, we do a combination of looking at procedures you have in place to help you comply with the rules, but we also do substantive testing, which is we choose a sample of trades and we try to verify that whatever fields were required to be reported have been reported. We look at the timing of your reporting. We try to understand, if you're late, why it is late. Are you meeting the requirement as soon as technologically as practicable? So I think, right now, we have shared information on what we are seeing across firms with the Canadian regulators, and they have with us. It's only a start of collaboration. Might be even strong, but it's just a start of communication. But I think, hopefully in the future, if we're looking at SDR reporting and someone else is looking at SDR reporting and we're able to communicate with the other regulators, maybe there's a create opportunities to sort of leverage each other and maybe create some more standards. I'm just thinking.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Hi. You touched upon reporting of trades that were previously inaccurately reported. When we have trades that went through multiple amendments, is the expectation that we send out the last known state of the trade, or should we report all the amendments that the trade went through?
So you're asking if you report a trade and after that you realize something was wrong, maybe some field was wrong.
Or the trade got amended by the counterparty on multiple occasions. They, they partially terminated on several occasions. Do we report when we go? Then we didn't report all these instances. Do we just go and report the last instance when the trade was alive? Or?
So the CFTC requirements require this is continuation data, really, and it's a daily reporting requirement, right? So I think if by the end of the day you report the correct data, because they're going to have a snapshot of every day what that data is, I would recommend at least at the end of every day you have the latest information in reported. I'm just going on the technical read of the rules here.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I meant when your report traded is already dead, that you've trying to correct a previous mistake.
Yes, and you should report them to correct it.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, as I mentioned, SDR was very, very extensive, and I'm not surprised by the questions. It's a challenge, and I would just suggest that, you know, monitoring your reporting and keep looking at how you could improve it, improve your technology. That's the only way that you could, you know, slowly and slowly just improve your reporting processes, and you'll get better and better. So next, that concludes SDR, and we'll move to the next rule area. Tammy will discuss business conduct standards.
Thank you, Sharon. So for this rule area, we look at two main requirements. First, the general provisions. SWOT dealer has to know the essential facts of its counterparties prior to transacting. Also, SWOT dealer needs to design its policies and procedures and have monitoring control in place to ensure compliance with rules. The other main rule requirement pertain to making disclosures to counterparties. There are two main disclosures. General relationship level disclosure, which include material risk, material incentives, and conflicts of interest that SWOT dealer may have. The second disclosure is the relationship transactional level disclosures. The firm must provide a PTMM and disclose material economic terms prior to execution. These allow counterparties to assess the transactions. In addition, the SWOT dealer must provide daily mark to its counterparties. Now I will go over some common issues we are seeing pertain to this rule area. To obtain the essential facts, firms generally rely on the onboarding process to obtain the necessary documentation from counterparties and use various reports to identify any missing documentation. However, we have seen situations where reports are inaccurate or have a large number of false positives, which make difficult to identify true exceptions. Sometimes, this is a result of a firm having their client data fragmented across multiple systems. We also see situations where true exceptions appear in a report, but the firm did not diligently resolve them. This occurs mostly for legacy counterparties onboarded pre-Dodd-Frank. In particular for non-US SWOT dealers, we see firms fail to comply with this set of the rules because the firm did not correctly identify a counterparty as a U.S. person. We noticed that many firms use market platform, which streamlines the process for obtaining counterparty documentation and essential facts. Market allow the firms to manually extract counterparty information, but more and more we are seeing firms automating this process. However, we have noticed that some firms do not reflect the updated information received from markets in their client internal client database. So the onboarding process is not only used to obtain essential facts, it is also used for the firm to provide general disclosures. So quite often, if you have issues obtaining essential facts of a counterparty, you may also have issues providing the required disclosures to the counterparties. Many firms provide disclosure by providing counterparties with links to their website that contain the general disclosures. However, many times we have noticed that these links are no longer valid. So it seems firms set the link when the rule becomes effective, but they don't really have a periodic check to make sure the link is still work. Another disclosure that firms are failing to provide is PTMM. In particular, where the firm is relying on sales and trading personnel to provide PTMM, either through phone conversations or in writing. We have seen that they are not always diligent in providing the PTMM prior to transacting. We recommend the firm to do periodic testing to monitor for compliance. Lastly, I would like to mention that some firms incorrectly rely on no action letters. There are three no action letters that offer some relief in providing PTMM. However, the conditions for relying on these no action letters are very specific, so attention to detail is needed if you rely on no action letters. To give you an idea of the detailed requirements, I'm going to take a no action letter 1242 as an example. So the following requirements must be met. First, the real-time bid and offer are available electronically. Second, the counterparty agree in writing that swap dealer does not need to disclose PTMM. Third, it only apply to FS swaps and forwards that are physically settled, and each currency is a BIS 13 deliverable currency and has a maturity of 1 year or less. Lastly, it only apply to vanilla FS options that are physically settled in a BIS 13 deliverable currency and has a maturity of 6 months or less. As you can see, these are very specific conditions, which means only certain FS transactions qualify for the relief in providing PTMM. However, we have noticed some firms incorrectly rely on this no action letter for all FS transactions. So, if you have any questions, I will take some questions before I hand it over to move on to the next session. Okay. So as Shuna mentioned earlier, correctly classify counterparties is essential, especially for non-US swap dealers. For non-US swap dealers, some CFTC rules only apply if dealing with US person guarantee affiliates and condo affiliates. This is mostly applicable for transactional level requirements and include, for example, external business conduct standards, real-time public reporting, and segregation, which we just discussed. It therefore becomes important for non-US firms to correctly classify which counterparties are US versus non-US and which counterparty are condo affiliates and guarantee affiliates. Failure to classify a counterparty into a correct status prior to transacting may result in non-compliance with this set of the rules. So we noticed that an effective rule, a way for firms to determine this classification is obtaining cross-border representation letters from counterparties. This should be standard requirement when onboarding a counterparty. This can also be facilitated through market platforms. So if you don't have any question, we conclude the key findings that we have seen from our recent examinations. I will hand it over to Shuna to cover trader incidents.
Thank you. So trader incidents. Over the past several months, we have had a small number of similar trader incidents reported to us and thought it was useful to include in today's discussion. Before we get into the incidents, let's review the applicable rules. The business conduct standards prohibits a swap dealer to engage in fraudulent, deceptive, or manipulative trade practices, the straight prohibition. Then another set of rules in the risk management program requires a swap dealer to have a supervisory system, requires a swap dealer to diligently supervise business activities of employees, importantly also to establish means to detect unauthorized trading or other violations of policies and procedures. Therefore, engaging in abusive trading and not having proper supervision and not having monitoring in place will be considered a regulatory failure. So you might be interested, well, how does NFA become aware of trader incidents? There are different ways. If you have gone through our examination, you know that as part of a routine examination, we may ask for a list of trader incidents over the past year. Another way we become aware of incidents is when firms include that information in the quarterly risk exposure reports they file to NFA and the CFTC. We do encourage firms to self-report issues, especially those involving abusive trading or manipulative trading that result in termination of an employee. The other way we learn of information is, you know, just through the press. We do have a group of individuals who monitor the news for information. In the past, information that came to us this way has been more of the bigger cases, for example, when a number of firms were fined for manipulating benchmarks, FX benchmarks, LIBORs. So our preferred way of receiving this information is for firms to self-report to us. So what do we do when we become aware of a trader incident? When we become aware of an incident, our objective is to determine the nature and extent of the incident. What was the impact to counterparties? What is the impact on the firm's books and records? We also look at the firm's handling of the incident. Was it thorough? Have they determined the full extent of the incident? And have they taken appropriate actions? I think this would speak a lot to, you know, the firm's culture of or tone or tolerance for these type of things. We also look to see, identify what control failures allowed these incidents to occur or not be detected for a period of time. And we also then assess the firm's remediation of these control failures. We would look at whether the remediation that's performed is reasonable. For example, also, if a firm identifies a control failure in one desk, we'd expect the firm to consider implementing similar remediation steps in other desks where the same type of incident could occur. So expect if you report something to us on the FX desk and we think it could happen in your rates desk, then expect us to ask you, where else have you rolled out this type of remediation? So I will now get into more about the type of incidents we saw. And I said it's similar, and we had about a handful. The incidents we saw that were self-reported to us involved unauthorized internal trading, where a trader, to hide losses or to increase his own P&L, booked unauthorized trades against another trader's book. In the cases we saw, the activity could have been ongoing for a couple months, up to a couple years. And when it was not detected early, it was because the trades were very small, or the trades were immaterial from a risk position perspective. However, the trades created P&L for the trader, and that P&L accumulated over time for the perpetrator. So quite often, these types of unauthorized trades, if they are small, may not be detected immediately by the other trader, one, due to the large number of trades that are executed daily, or due to the size of the P&L involved. So, what did the firm have in place before these incidents occurred? Right? Most firms have procedures in place. A lot of firms relied on a trader review of P&L to identify possible inappropriate trading. If a trader doesn't recognize the P&L, they should question the P&L. Especially, I know traders would question losses, right? However, if the losses are small over time and it just doesn't get the attention, it will not be recognized until one day. In some cases, it went on for 2 years. It became noticed. Another way of firms have that could identify an unauthorized trading is a review of cancel and corrects. But I think many of you are quite aware that there are so many cancel corrects sometimes that it's going to be very hard to detect whether one trade is unauthorized out of hundreds of cancel and corrects. I do mention, though, in one situation, it was identified through a cancel correct, and that's only because there was another group that was looking at cancel corrects. They were working in the it's a control group, if you guys are familiar with, and they were looking for cancel corrects just before the announcement of major news, like an M&A, for example, and some investment banking news. And because they were focused on those types of cancel corrects, they came across it and started asking questions. So obviously, something else needed to be done once these trade incidents were identified. So what have firms done differently? So one is the firms are requiring traders to affirm or acknowledge interbook trades booked by another trader. In the past, it's not unusual, first of all, let me say, it's not unusual for a trader to book another trade with another trader. But in all situations, there should have been communications where they say, I need to do this FX swap for this date. Can you do it with me? And there would be a verbal acknowledgement, and they would go ahead and book the trade, right? Because it's internal, it doesn't require your formal confirmation that you'd normally send to external counterparties. Now they have tighten that process. So it's not just a informal phone call or acknowledgement. You know, they are requiring traders to affirm back that the trades, affirm back these internal trades between two traders. There are also reports that are used to look back at all interbook activity to make sure the traders are comfortable with the trades that have been booked by another trader against their books. Another type of report we have seen focusing on interbook trades are to look at back-to-back trades and to make sure that the P&L are equal and offsetting. There's no reason why if you do a trade between two desks in a firm, it creates P&L between the two firms. It should be equal and offsetting. What one makes, one loses. So these are types of reports that firms have implemented to try to detect these type of unauthorized trading. We are sharing this information to you because we think, you know, it's good practice. They only implemented it after the incident occurred. If it's not being implemented at your firm, you shouldn't wait for an incident to occur to implement it. You should consider implementing some form of acknowledgement of these types of trades between traders. So if anyone has any questions, you know, this concludes the exam update, findings and themes. Yes, okay.
Is the NFA just looking at the control process over like P&L, or are they looking at things like P&L attribution and that sort of thing?
There are rules in the risk management program. So keep in mind, if you're U.S. swap dealers, the risk management program requires business unit supervision. And therefore, we would expect, we'd look at supervision to make sure that there is a framework for traders to sign off on their P&L and for reporting to be provided to senior management. We also look at the independent reviews. Those rules also require the firm to have independent valuations testing. So yes, as part of a risk management program, we would look at the process to make sure that your valuations are correct, your P&L is reported correctly. We did a risk management program a couple of years ago, and I don't know if any of you recall, but we did some work on it.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I have a question for non-U.S. swap dealers that we have substitute compliance for the risk management program. Would the NFA also examine the sections of the risk management program that does not have the substitute compliance?
I think the question is, would we be looking at that part of the risk management program that does not have substitute compliance? Is that the question?
Right. There's exception for the substitute compliance in the risk management program.
So when we look at the risk management program, we look at it holistically. And if we see issues that are not covered by substitute compliance, clearly those are within our purview. But if we notice things that are even covered by substitute compliance, we're not going to hesitate to let the firm know that we see those issues. Although if they're covered by substitute compliance, the way the rules are currently written, we wouldn't be able to take much action. But remember that if we see it, we want to let you know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Also, if it is not covered by substitute compliance, it doesn't mean that we'll automatically look at it. We do take a risk-based approach to exams. And so depending on where we think our energy should be focused on, you know, we could look at it. I was just thinking as Joe was speaking, a lot of the main area that's not under substitute compliance is the quarterly reporting that the firm has to do. So non-U.S. swap dealers still have to do quarterly reports, right? I think that's the biggest piece that's not under substituted compliance. And so whether we look at quarterly reporting, it's all will come down to, as Joe mentioned earlier, you know, we look at specific types of data, and then we will consider all the relevant rule areas and determine whether we would want to do some work in that area.
Hi. In regards to trader incidents, I've seen the question, standard question during the exams and also within the management rep letter at the conclusion of an exam. One thing I notice is the language in the question during the exam is different than the management rep letter. I guess I'm wondering, is that by design or an unintended consequence, unintended drafting? So during the exam, it's more where trader incidents that the firm is identified, and I think you can say that you concluded on those, whereas in the management rep letter, it almost introduces language about what the firm is investigating or looking into. There's a difference between the two. Don't know if anyone else has noticed that.
Let us take that back.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's an interesting observation. Let us take it back.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll just add it was drafted at different times. So
no, I just pointed out I did see the difference, and when speaking with people, it was a little bit of a, because I think the way the management rep letter is written, it implies that you should have disclosed those during the exam, but the document request was different during the exam. So
okay, so.
So we have about 4 minutes. We're going to try and end on time. What we're going to do is talk about upcoming swap exams when we come back from break. So we can take the break now, and then we'll come back and start with that.
This is a.
Tammy's there.
Okay, yeah, if you want to grab Tammy, I'll grab her. All right. If everyone wouldn't mind taking their seats, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. All right. At this point in time, I think we're going to go ahead and start talking about our upcoming swap dealer examinations. So I'd like to welcome Tammy back up to the stage to talk a little bit about that. Thanks.
Thank you, Christine. So we save the best for last. So we did this on purpose to make sure you're coming back to our exam session of the workshop. In wrapping up the examination portion of today's workshop, we would like to share with you what could be included in the scope of an upcoming examination of your firms. As mentioned earlier, NFA take a risk-based approach to examination and tailor the scope of an examination of a firm. In addition, we also attempt to include rule areas we have not yet examined for a firm. The rule areas, if we have not yet reviewed for your firm, if there is an upcoming exam schedule, which we may include the following rules. I did notice that SDR reporting is not in one of those bullets. As you can already tell we have examining firm for that rule areas. So if we haven't examined your firm yet, or if we haven't covered that rule area for your firm, SDR reporting will be in the scope. So as you can tell, the rule areas that we cover is pretty extensive. Right? So we have business conduct standards, margins, so margin both IM, initial margin and variation margins, and segregation, and business BCDRs, cybersecurity, and risk management program. For risk management programs, we have covered many areas past. We cover market risk, we cover risk governance, credit risk, and some of the firm make already we cover some operational risk aspect as well. So in here, so you see the top areas talking about new product approval, liquidity risk, and settlement risk. Right? So in closing, I would like to thank you for attending today's workshop. We hope you have found it to be informative and helpful. We welcome any suggestions that you may have for us. And please feel free to reach out to any one of us. So if you have any questions, I can take some questions. If not, then let's move on to the next topic of our agendas.
Thank you, Tommy. So up next, we'd like to briefly go over some recent NFA initiatives, and the one that we'd like to focus on more extensively is the swaps proficiency requirements. So to start, my name's Kristen Scaletta, and I'm an Associate Director of Communications at NFA, and I have the pleasure of being a member of the internal working group that is working on developing these requirements. And Sudhir, would you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. My name is Sudhir Jain. I'm a director on the OTC derivative side at NFA, and I do have the same pleasure to be on the same working group as Kristen and develop these swap proficiency requirements for the industry.
So I'd like to start by going over some of the background of this program and then also talking about the overall structure, and then I'll turn it over to Sudhir, who's going to talk about how NFA intends to impose these requirements, and he'll also touch on the application to non-U.S. swap dealers. So first, NFA's registration rules require APs that engage in both futures and forex activities to take and pass proficiency requirements, which cover both market knowledge and also knowledge of regulatory requirements. And there are currently no analogous requirements for APs that engage in swaps activities. So with the support of the CFTC and also the approval of NFA's board, NFA, as you know, is in the process of developing swaps proficiency requirements. And these requirements will apply to both APs of swap dealers and also swap APs at FCMs, IBs, CPOs, and CTAs. In order to develop these requirements, NFA's board initially approved the formation of a swaps proficiency requirements advisory committee, which is composed of industry experts that represent the member firms that will be impacted by these requirements, the membership categories, I should say, as well as a public director who's here with us today, Ron Filler, has been integral in the work of this group. And we, of course, are also working closely with the CFTC and members through our advisory committees and also through the various trade associations, and will continue to do so. So in terms of structure of these requirements, they'll be in the form of an online learning program with an embedded examination. And overall, there are 8 discrete modules that APs of swap dealers and swap APs will need to take the applicable modules in order to satisfy the requirements. And these modules cover everything ranging from the regulation of the swap market to swap products and application to risk management and more. Because there are 8 modules, we anticipate the overall program will take approximately 8 hours, but individuals will be able to take it from their own computers. You don't have to go to a testing center. So you'll be able to do it over time and enter and exit modules at any time. And each module, like I mentioned, is discrete. So it starts with the training portion, and then there's a short examination testing only on the knowledge in that module. Which brings me to timing of these requirements. We anticipate the effective date of these requirements will be in early 2020. And because there are no grandfathering provisions, we are setting a compliance date for these requirements that will be 1 year after the effective date. So you have the entire year to work through the 8-hour program at your leisure. However, after the compliance date, in order to engage in SWAPS activities, APs will need to have taken and passed the requirements. And now I will turn it over to Sudhir to talk about how NFA will impose these requirements.
Thank you, Kristen. So in order to implement these requirements, we are making some changes to our rules, and we are also adopting an interpretive notice. I'll cover this in three different parts. Let me start with talking about how we are imposing these requirements on different type of APs. So as intermediary SWAP APs are NFA members, but the APs at a SWAP dealer firm are not NFA members, we are imposing these requirements in two different ways. For intermediary SWAP APs, and when I say intermediary SWAP APs, I mean SWAP APs at FCM, CPO, CTAs, and SWAP IBs. As they are NFA members, we are putting the onus on them, and it is just like Series 3 requirement that they have to satisfy the requirement of SWAP proficiency requirements to be eligible to become a SWAP AP. We are also imposing the requirement on those firms, the intermediary firms, to make sure that they don't associate with any individual who is acting as an AP but has not met the requirement of this, of SWAP proficiency requirements. Sorry, too many requirements out there. It's a tongue twister. For the APs at SWAP dealers, because they are not NFA members, the onus is on the SWAP dealers to ensure that they don't associate with any individual who is working as a SWAP, who is working as an AP, but has not satisfied these requirements. We are making these changes by making an amendment to our Bylaw 301 as well as Compliance Rule 224. The second thing I would want to talk about are the two tracks of the requirement. So we are adopting a long track and a short track. The long track would take approximately 8 hours and would cover all the modules Kristen just mentioned about. And the short track would cover a subset of those modules and would take approximately 4 hours. The intermediary SWAP APs would take the short track. They do have the option to take the long track, but they would be required at least to take the short track. For the APs of the SWAP dealers, they can take the long track or the short track depending on the role they perform. So if an AP is in a sales and trading role and is pricing, executing, negotiating swaps, or is engaged in risk management of swaps, they would have to take the long track. However, if an AP is not performing any of those roles, and we do recognize that different firms might be organized in different ways. So if you do have APs who are not engaged in sales and trading role and are not pricing, negotiating, executing swaps, or are not doing risk management for swaps, they do have the option to take the short track. They can still take the long track. We don't expect very many APs at the swap dealers to take the short track, but we wanted to put that option out there, you know, because it was raised as one of the feedback from the member community. The supervisors would also have to take the SWAP proficiency requirements, and they would take the same track as the individuals they are supervising. So if you're supervising individuals who are taking the long track, you have to take the long track. But if you're only supervising individuals who are only taking the short track, you only have to take the short track. The requirements, once you pass the SWAP proficiency requirement and you change jobs, you won't have to do it again. We do have a 2-year cooling off requirement, but generally if you're moving from one SWAP dealer to another, you would not have to take the test. If you're moving from being a SWAP AP at an intermediary firm to a SWAP dealer, you may have to take the longer track because you may have only taken the shorter track and the new job requires you to take the long track. The last piece I want to talk about is how we are imposing these requirements, or I should say how we are not imposing these requirements on non-US APs. When we roll this out, you would see that the requirements are heavily weighted towards external business conduct and, you know, in particular, actually, transaction-level requirements, more Category B. And in July 2013, CFTC rolled out their own guidance on how those requirements apply for in transactions with non-US persons and non-US swap dealers. So we are modeling our exemption similar to what CFTC rolled out in 2013. In summary, if you are an AP of a non-US swap dealer, or if you are an AP at a non-US branch of a US swap dealer, and you are only transacting with a non-US person or a non-US branch of a US person, you would not have to take the test. Okay? So the exemption is quite similar. I'm pretty sure you have some questions. This was what I wanted to convey, but happy to take any questions you may have at this point.
Is there any consequence to failing the exam? For example, would you have to wait a period of time before you retake the exam?
That's a good question. No, there is no waiting period before retaking the exam. The way that we're structuring it, though, you do have to retake the learning portion if you failed that portion of the exam. So the consequence would be compliance date. You don't pass the exam, you won't be able to do business as a swap AP or AP of swap.
So just to be clear, if you take the 8-hour course and then fail the exam, you would have to retake that 8-hour course?
Only the modules that you failed.
Only the modules. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. For APs who are outside of the U.S., has NFA consulted with local laws to make sure that they can actually take the exam? Because, like in Germany, you need Workers' Council approval and you need a local translation. I think the same is also in France. So how would those APs actually take the exam if they're not permitted to take the exam?
That's an interesting question. We did talk about APs outside of U.S., but it has not been raised that if you are in Germany, then you would need the Workers' Council, like, express approval to take the test. They would only have to take the test if they are dealing with a U.S. person based in U.S.
Right, but if they're dealing with U.S. persons, how has NFA talked about the Workers' Council?
It's something for us to take away, and we'll look at it. I'm glad you raised it, but it has not been raised before, and we did consider talking to, like, non-U.S. regulators, but that's an interesting aspect which we can take away.
And also, I have an additional question. How does the swap dealer ensure that the APs have passed the exam? Is there a local database or somewhere where we could actually pull their, you know, certificate that they've passed this exam?
Yes, at the end of the requirements, every individual who passes it will receive a certificate, and then compliance officers at swap dealers will be able to access a database that has all of that information. And as we get further into developing these programs, we'll provide additional training in the form of webinars and notices to members to give you the specifics as to how to access all of that.
Thank you. Is it considered, since you can take this on your own computer or your work computer, is it considered that it would be an open book exam, or as a swap dealer, should we be ensuring that we sort of proctor the exams in a similar way that one would for a Series 3 or 7?
We are allowing APs to take this on their own computer. Once an AP has gone through the training and has entered the testing portion, they won't be allowed to go back into the training. And there will also be attestations saying, like, for example, I won't cheat, I won't cross-reference, things like that. So it's up to the swap dealer as to how much you would like to control that.
In terms of continuing education requirements, will there be such a requirement?
There will not be a continuing education requirement at this time.
Hi, you mentioned that supervisors would need to take the same exam or track that the teams that they supervise. So I understand that for the one-up supervisor, but as you proceed through the supervisory hierarchy, how is that viewed?
So we are going by the definition of the APs as is already defined by CFTC in Reg 1.3. So you have to be an AP to take this test. If you are not already an AP, it does not matter if you are a supervisor or not. So the AP definition says that you must be, you know, like executing swaps, soliciting and accepting swaps, and their supervisor. So all we mean is if you are an AP, already defined AP, and you are not executing swaps, but you are only supervising the APs, then you would have to take the same track as the people who are actually executing swaps. But it doesn't go up the chain. So if you are not an AP, you are not bound by these requirements at all.
Does that help?
I think we have a different interpretation.
Say that again.
I think I have a different interpretation on the supervisory hierarchy, so I'll take it offline and separate.
Okay.
So sort of follow up on the platform. Is this going to be kind of like a FINRA broker check where it's public knowledge, public information for proficiency satisfaction? So, for example, a new hire who has taken the proficiency in another firm crosses over. How can you access the information? Is this private where just like a certificate will satisfy, or is there a central hub where you can refer to?
NFA will have that information. So if an individual is transferring from one swap dealer to another, the individual can provide the firm with the certificate, or NFA will be able to provide that information. But it will not be listed on basic whether or not they have the specific proficiency requirement. What will be listed is that they are or are not a swap AP if the individual is already in basic.
Does this requirement apply to like CTAs and CPOs and other registered entities as well? Like if you have like a portfolio manager at a CTA?
If you are a swap AP at a CTA or CPO or IB or FCM, which is one of the designations that you can fill out when you're registering, you need to meet these requirements in order to maintain that designation.
So how do these requirements apply to the supervisors who sign off on trades?
If they are identified as, let's say if you are at a swap dealer and the supervisor is an AP because they are supervising people who solicit and accept swaps, then they would have to take the same track as the people they are supervising.
And for just a run-of-the-mill CPO, CTA, if a trader places a trade and books it and a portfolio manager signs off on that, then both the trader and the PM have to be certified.
If they both are swap APs, they would have to satisfy the requirement to retain the designation of swap AP.
Thank you.
I think we have time for one or two more questions now, but Sudhir and I are going to be available at the break, and as I'm assuming Ron Filler will be as well, to answer any additional questions.
I'll just quickly ask, do you have an example of a role where somebody would take the short track? Because from your description, you said sales and trading, and anyone who supervises them would have to take the long track, and the AP definition is anyone who solicits or executes on behalf of the swap dealer. So I'm just trying to envision who could take a short track specifically, or at least an example.
Yeah. So generally we expect most of the APs, if not all the APs at a swap dealer, would be taking the long track. Having said that, we know that there are some firms who have identified a larger population as APs, which may not strictly meet the definition of the AP as such. And then I've heard that there are folks in wealth management particularly who would just be referring clients to their trading desk and not be negotiating, not be executing or pricing swaps. So they may be in a position to take the short track. We don't expect that to be very many, but we left the option out there just in case you have people who fall in that category.
Hi. If you were to lead the NFA for a period of over 2 years, similar to the Series 3 or the Series 31, do you lose that designation? If you come back at a later date, do you have to sit for those the 8 modules again?
So if, let's say, you are at an intermediary firm and you are a swap AP and you go and start working for a swap dealer, you would not have to, and you are an AP at the swap dealer as well, you'd not have to take the test. But assume you are working at a swap dealer and you went on to work for, let's say, a corporate in, say, IBM in their treasury, you may still be trading swaps, but you would not be at a swap dealer. And if you're out for 2 years, you'd have to take the test.
I went to work for a bigger BP and I was not associated with a swap dealer. Would I need to retake the exam if more than 2 years passed?
Yes. If you're not a swap AP in that two-year time period, you would have to take the test. That's correct. Yeah.
These are all great questions. I'm sure there are many more. So like I said, Sudhir and I will be available after this to answer any of your additional questions. Really briefly, before I turn it over, a couple of additional new NFA initiatives are we continue to update our online registration system, which, like the slide says, includes improved navigation and increased efficiency. So I think we're in about the third phase of this project and will soon be launching the new firm application process. To date, we've added a new member dashboard and also updated the individual application process. And we are also updating our basic system, the user experience. So you can stay tuned for some of those updates coming in the coming, 3 to 6 months. And now I would like to turn it over to Cindy Kane Iannacci, who's going to walk us through our business conduct committee process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kristen. Good morning, everyone. I am Cynthia Kane Iannacci. I'm an enforcement attorney with NFA. And at prior swap dealer member workshops, we've provided a fairly detailed overview of the disciplinary process at NFA. Today, we'd like to take a little bit of a different approach, and rather than walk through everything, just focus on two main areas and provide a statistical overview of those areas. And they happen to involve complaints and decisions. Part 3 of NFA's compliance rules governs the disciplinary process. The complaint is usually issued after there has been an exam or an investigation that's conducted by either the OTC derivatives compliance team or the futures compliance team, and they find serious violations of NFA rules. And sometimes those violations could also involve underlying violations of CFTC regulations. For example, NFA Compliance Rule 2-49A provides that any violation of CFTC Regulation 3.3, which is the Chief Compliance Officer area, or any violation under Part 23 of the CFTC regulations constitutes a violation of NFA rules. So if we have those kinds of findings during an exam or investigation, there are other NFA rules that apply to the swaps area, and NFA is actually in the process of expanding and modifying rules to apply to the swaps business. So again, if we find serious violations during an exam or investigation, the exam team is going to bring that to the attention of the legal department, and we will work together to prepare what we call an investigation report. That report will summarize our findings, the alleged rule violations, and contain a recommendation for our business conduct committee to authorize a complaint. We'll present those findings to the committee, and if they authorize the issuance of a complaint, a written complaint will be issued, and it will identify the alleged rule violations and the conduct that gave rise to those violations. This is a written document that will serve on the member firm. It's also a public document that will be displayed in our basic system. The member will have 30 days to file an answer to the complaint where they can deny the allegations, admit in part, but set forth their response to NFA's findings. Over the years, if I can do this right, the last 5 years, this chart shows kind of our complaint activity. Most of these cases, virtually all of them, are futures compliance cases. We have an average of 20 complaints a year. The high was in 2015 of this five-year period when we had about 40 cases. We have taken 3 cases against swap dealer members. 2 of those cases were against firms that were primarily operating in the retail FX space, but they were also provisionally registered as swap dealers, and the exams found deficiencies with their risk management programs, so they were charged with violating 249A. We also had a swap dealer case last year. That firm had deficiencies with its initial margin model and monitoring. So those are the only cases we've issued so far against swap dealers. But as the program matures and our exams are now more risk-focused, it is possible that we will have additional swap dealer complaints in the future. Once a complaint is issued, it's going to take one of two paths. There's either going to be a settlement or it's going to go to a hearing. But no matter which path it follows, there's going to be a written decision issued at the end of it. The vast majority of NFA's cases settle. And so that's where NFA and the member firm, generally their legal counsel, we're going to work together to try to find a mutually agreeable settlement. And once we agree to those terms, we're going to present that settlement offer to either the Business Conduct Committee or to the hearing panel. And which group it goes to depends on whether or not there's been a chairperson appointed yet to the hearing panel. If one hasn't been appointed, it's going to go to the BCC, and they'll decide whether or not to accept the settlement offer. If a chairperson has been appointed, it will go to the full hearing panel, which is made up of 3 individuals, and they'll decide whether or not to accept the offer. Types of penalties that can be imposed range from fines of up to $250,000 per violation. And let me give you an example. This is going to be simple of how it could work. Let's say that a member firm files quarterly reports with NFA, and 3 of those reports contained inaccurate information, and they knew the information was inaccurate. If we brought a case against the firm, we could charge up to $250,000 for each inaccurate report. That would never probably happen, but it just gives you an example that each report is considered a violation, and we could fine according to that violation. We can also suspend members from membership. We can, for a temporary period, we can expel members from membership, and we can impose remedial actions. Typically, in an NFA case, you're going to see a fine imposed with remedial action. And the remedial action are undertakings that staff will require the firm to implement to address the deficiencies that were identified through the exam and investigation and that were the subject of the complaint. In a settled case, there's going to be a written decision issued, but it's going to be brief in terms of the information that it contains. It will summarize the charges from the complaint. Most of our decisions will indicate whether there's an admission or denial by the member firm, and then it will set forth the penalty that was agreed to through the settlement and approved by the BCC or the hearing panel. If a case goes to hearing, the decision is going to be much longer because it's going to not only summarize the charges in the complaint, but it's also going to include a summary of the evidence that was presented at the hearing, and it's going to include findings and conclusions that the hearing panel made. In both instances, these decisions are made public. This chart shows our activity in the decision area over the last 5 years. You can see, again,
that's right. 2015 was our most active year. On average, I think in 2015 we had over 40 decisions, but on average we have about 25 decisions issued each year. And that's a little bit higher than the number of complaints that we issue. And that's because sometimes cases involve multiple parties and they don't always agree on how they want to handle the charges against them. You might have a member firm with a former employee named in a case, and the member firm is like, we're going to settle this, we want to put this behind us, and so we'll reach a settlement with the firm. The employee, on the other hand, wants to fight the charge and end up going to a hearing against the employee. So you could find one complaint that has multiple decisions. Let's see. Now, this chart shows our fine activity in NFA cases. And in 2014, we had fairly high fine activity. Through this five-year period, we imposed about $7.5 million in fines, and 2014 represented about $2.7 million of that total amount. The majority of the $2.7 million in fines was attributable to one member firm that had been the subject of prior disciplinary cases before. So, you know, the fine was increased because it took into account that factor. And on average, though, approximately two-thirds of our cases involve fines of $30,000 or less. Again, that's in the futures compliance arena. We do take a number of factors into consideration when we impose fines. First of all, the CFTC has issued a policy statement in 1994 about factors that SROs are supposed to take into account when imposing fines in disciplinary cases. NFA also looks at whether the firm's been named in a case before, maybe the monetary gain that the member had as a result of the misconduct, and if any counterparties or customers were harmed by their actions. As I said before, NFA settles a lot of its cases. Therefore, we have a very high success rate in collecting the fines that are imposed. That's because we've negotiated with the party on the fine amount, and so they know what it's going to be, and they often want to stay in business, so they're going to pay the fine. So overall, NFA has an active enforcement program, but we only issue a modest number of cases each year, and we issue a modest number of decisions each year. And for the most part, our fine amounts are not significantly high. I think if you look at FINRA, annually, they collect $65 million or $175 million each year in fine activity. We're closer, as I said, to 2.7 in an active year. So we just wanted you to have a better idea of more of the activity in the enforcement area, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
I have a question. What FINRA does when there's exams is they issue a disposition letter after the firm responds, letting the firm know whether something's being referred to enforcement or whether they know that there won't be any action. Does the NFA do something similar, and if so, is it different on the futures versus the swap dealer side?
That's a good question. We do not issue a formal disposition letter. However, during the course of the exam or an investigation, the firm should have a sense that this is serious, viewed seriously by NFA. In addition, when we issue our written examination reports, you will see language most often. If this could go down a disciplinary path, there will be language included in the very first paragraph or two of the exam report that says something to the effect that these are considered serious violations of serious violations and may be grounds for an action under Part 3 of the compliance rules. So you should have an indication either through the process or when you get the exam report that this could be a matter that we would consider for enforcement action.
So my question is, and I think you've partially answered that a little bit, but I'll ask it anyway. What makes you go down the road of going for a complaint? I'll venture to say that every firm in this room, whether they're on the OTC derivative side or on the future side, will have who have been or are yet to be examined by the NFA in this current round of examinations, have, you know, violations or mistakes or errors, mm-hmm. call it whatever, breaches, call it whichever way you want to call it, because even the CFTC says nobody can be 100% perfect 100% of the time.
Right.
So where do you, how do you differentiate between, yes, you have these issues, you need to have a remediation plan in process, in place, et cetera, versus we're taking you down a complaint path?
Okay, that's a good question. Let me give you a couple of examples to hopefully put it in context. With the two FX, retail FX firms that I talked about, they were provisionally registered as swap dealers. And as I said, they had deficient risk management programs. Both of those firms, well, the one firm specifically ran into capital problems, and they were not adequately monitoring their capital at the firm because they had a deficient risk management program. They knew what their business model was, but they didn't retain an adequate capital reserve or put protective measures in place to monitor that they were getting into danger. And so there was an adverse market event in the Swiss franc market a few years ago, and the firm ended up being on the wrong side of that market and caused harm not only to the firm but to a lot of its clients. So that was an egregious situation, which is why we charged that firm. The other firm, I think, got in trouble at the same time around the Swiss market event, but the problem there is 4 months earlier, they ran into another capital situation where they were undercapitalized and had to get an infusion from an affiliate in Australia. So we did not take an action on the first event, but when they were charged by the CFTC and agreed to put undertakings in place, and 4 months later they're back in the same situation, then that was a problem for both the commission and NFA. Another example might be a firm that we work with you. We try to help you be in compliance with the NFA rules and the CFTC regulations, but if we continue to have problems with the firm, like three exams, and we're seeing repeat deficiencies, then we're going to take a case. Probably the clearest example of when we're going to take a case is fraud. If we find fraudulent activity, we find, and granted, knowing that the swaps is a principal-to-principal marketplace, we don't want to see a member firm lying to the counterparty about what's going on. We don't want to see that in the futures compliance world either. But those are examples of what we're talking about when we see serious violations. Does that help? Okay. Any other questions?
How do you coordinate with the CFTC on disciplinary actions? Is it the case that one or the other will take an action, or could you both at certain circumstances?
Our philosophy at NFA is we, and I hate to use the word pile on, we don't want to pile on. We believe that if we've developed a case and we think it has a serious impact or effect on NFA's rules, then we're going to bring an action. If NFA and the CFTC are both looking at the same matter, same action, same rule violations, we are going to have a conversation with the commission to determine who should bring the case. If we have I'm going to try to think of an example, but if we have something that's a specific interest which is different from the commission, then we may take an action. But generally, we're going to look to see where's the commission at, how far away are they from bringing their action, what's the harm if we wait, and if everything is equal and there's not any risk or problems with NFA stepping back, then we're going to step back. This is a futures compliance example, but it illustrates maybe a situation where we would both proceed. we've talked before about one of our enforcement tools. It's very important. It's called a member responsibility action, and we use that when there is an ongoing harm in the marketplace, not only to members, but customers or counterparties. And we took an action a few years ago because a pool operator took about a $4 million loan out of a commodity pool 3 years earlier and wasn't paying it back. And so we gave him a deadline of December 31st and said, you have to pay this loan back by that time or we're going to stop you from trading. So he went to a hearing. He lost at the hearing. The hearing panel said, no, you've had 3 years. You've got to pay the loan back. And if you don't do it by this date that NFA set, you're going to be prohibited from trading. Didn't pay the loan back. A few months later, and then we later took a disciplinary action and expelled the firm and the individual. A few months later, we get a call from the CME to let us know that the trader's tag 50, which is the access you have to Globex, had continued to be used during this time where they were under restrictions. And apparently he opened an account for his wife that we did not know about. And he continued to trade in her account and ran an allocation scheme where profitable trades were put in her account, and then he withdrew the money out, and we didn't know about it. So that was not good. Once we found that out, we did an investigation into the allocation scheme, referred it to the CFTC, and we both took actions in that matter against the FCMs that were involved. NFA's reason for doing it was because the MRA is such an important enforcement tool to us. If other members are not monitoring that they are carrying accounts with someone subject to restrictions under an MRA and they're letting money go out of an account, that's not good. And so we took it based on the principle to ensure that members know they have to monitor and comply with MRAs. The CFTC took actions mainly in one case because they had just charged a member firm 9 months earlier for another allocation scheme at the firm, and the firm didn't put adequate measures in place to prevent it from happening again. One last point on this. NFA meets quarterly. We try to meet quarterly with the CFTC enforcement staff. So we know, for the most part, what they're working on, and so that's where we have these coordination discussions about how to proceed. Probably more than you wanted to know, but any other questions? Oh, yes.
I think we're actually out of time for questions now, but Cindy will be available after, if that's all right, to answer.
Absolutely. As I said earlier, we have a packed agenda, and I want to make sure we stay on track. So thank you very much to Cindy and the rest of our presenters this morning. That was a great, great morning. And we'll plan on returning here at about 11:15 for those of you who are registered for cybersecurity. For those of you who did not register for cybersecurity, I'd just like to reiterate that if you could fill out one of those evaluation forms at your table before you leave, we would really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was nicer. That was nicer. Yes, that was nicer.